Now, this topic of fantasy and reality is one that has bothered philosophers and scientists for centuries. And we're not going to provide the final answer. That's an impossibility, because we live in a relative universe where our understanding, no matter how great it is only relative to a later understanding, which is better still. But we wish to gain insights. We wish to understand the difference between fantasy and reality. And this is a personal project that should confront everybody. Now, first of all, we need to understand what fantasy is. Now, the word fantasy is only an extended form of... It's only an extended form of the word fancy. Both fantasy and the word fancy come from an ancient Greek root. And this ancient Greek root is very important. We must heed its signification. And this word is as follows. Fantasy. That's how the ancient Greeks pronounced it. Now, fantasy is the root word from which fancy and fantasy have come forth. And this word root is very interesting, because it tells us it's something to be made known. It's something to be revealed. And we'll return to this concept of fantasy in just a little while. Now, this Greek word in turn has come from a much older word root in the Indo-European language, ba, which means to shine, to illuminate. So, in the original sense of the word, fantasy, coming from ba, means a revealing, a bringing forth, a disclosing, a making known. And you'll see a little later on how this works in the process of fantasy, hallucination, daydreaming. Now, everybody fantasizes. We don't like to admit it. In fact, if we say that we don't fantasize, we're liars. Nobody wants to be a liar, so we have to own up to it. We fantasize. We daydream. And there's no good saying it's a weak-minded person who falls into daydream. That's not true. It is the natural function of the mind to continually produce this daydreaming, fantasizing process. It's the natural activity of the unconscious mind to generate fantasies. There's nothing to be ashamed of in fantasies. What we should be ashamed of is falling into the grip of fantasies and allowing fantasies to rule us. And we're going to describe some of the methods used throughout the ages where people have learned to resist the flow of fantasy. So everybody fantasizes. It's a natural action of the mind. But it's how we handle those fantasies that counts. Now, in his spiritual diary, Swedenborg spoke about poor quality souls in the spiritual world who are in the grip of fantasy. And he said they live a life of pure fantasy. They are fantasies themselves, because they never see themselves in their real state. And all of their mentation consists of this daydreaming process, so that they never come to grips with reality. Now, if you ponder that for a few minutes, you can see that that's a dreadful state of affairs to fall into. Imagine living in a timeless world where you're surrounded by nothing but images of your own daydreaming process, and you never come to grips with what is loving, good, true, real, or substantial. You'd be living in clouds. And Swedenborg declares that there are people who live that way for thousands of years. You never know, our politicians might finish up there one day. Won't do them any harm. Now, in order to understand fantasy, we have to learn to do something very important to ourselves. We have to learn to observe ourselves. Now, again, this is where we fall into trouble, because we imagine that because we've lived with ourselves all of our lives, that somehow we understand ourselves. Other people know us better than we do. Other people can read us much better than we can read ourselves. That's the raw truth of it. And we don't like to admit this. But you see, many people can read body language, and they can see from our various gestures, our mannerisms, from the intonations of the voice, and that they're very skilled, from the slump of the shoulders, the caving in of the chest, the way the hips are rotated. Other people can read us like a book. We do not read ourselves like a book. And that is the great weakness that confronts us. Now, in Swedenborg's writings, we find that there is a remarkable challenge to everybody to learn to read themselves. And if you read The True Christian Religion, chapters 9 and 10, you'll find that here is a whole field of practical applied psychology. Now, although this was written over 200 years ago, the approach is sound. It is solid. It's one thing to go to a psychotherapist and to have help in bringing forth materials out of the psyche. We must learn to do it ourselves. In fact, we don't have to make things come out of the psyche. They're coming out all the time through our fantasies and through our nocturnal dreams at night. But how much notice do we take of these things? The unconscious mind speaks to us not in words, as a rule, but in symbols. Some of these symbols contain spiritual correspondences, that is, deeper meanings that relate to a higher reality. Even if they don't have that deep inward reach, everything that is expressed in our psyche is symbolic of some process, some function, some repression, some aberration of the psyche. And if we study these symbolic utterances that are coming out of us all the time, we can learn something about ourselves. Now, Swedenborg in his writing says that people should examine themselves, and he's very kind here, he says, once or twice a year. We should do it on a weekly basis, and sometimes we need to do it on a daily basis, because we live in a world where there is enormous pressure being applied to us all the time from the surroundings. Enormous factors are influencing us constantly. We in this modern age are accustomed to the noise of city traffic, to the pressure of driving through heavy traffic, to being on railways, to be in noisy places, to be in busy offices, in busy factories and busy laboratories. All that noise we've learned to adapt to and cope with. But those stresses are affecting us psychologically in very profound ways that we don't notice. In some cases, it can gradually engender psychosomatic cardiac disturbances, lung disturbances, gastrointestinal disturbances, and so on. We are a psychosomatically ill race of people. Now, this is not meant to be a denigration of the human race. We're trying to point out the plight of the human race, because everybody is subject to the artificiality of modern civilization. Now, when that pressure builds up inside us, something has to flow out. And the natural outflow is fantasy. So, if we say that this is the psyche, an enormous number of influences play upon the psyche. A lot of internal factors are at work. Repressed wishes, hopes that are not fulfilled. All this material builds up and builds up until something begins to ooze out, and what oozes out is fantasy. Fantasy is the natural safety valve for what is coming out of our psyche, and it helps to resolve some of the problems that we have inside. So it's important to see that fantasy has a function to play. Fantasy is to daily waking life what dreaming is to our sleeping life. Dreaming is a normal process, and everybody dreams. And in that dreaming process, certain things are expressed and acted out. Certain mental processes are readjusted. Many of our impressions of daily life are functionally reorganized and restructured, and energies are shifted around inside us. Daydreaming has the same sort of function. Now, our job is to understand what this daydreaming is about. Those who read Swedenborg, especially the Spiritual Diary, where he says so much about fantasy, will get a slightly one-sided picture of it. Because you must remember that in Swedenborg's day, the unconscious mind was not known. It wasn't until the beginning of this present century that the whole concept of the unconscious mind became clearly established. Swedenborg was one of the pioneers of psychology of spiritual insight. But the terminology wasn't available, and he wasn't basically a psychological researcher. He was searching for the soul. He was searching for deeper things than just factors in the mind. But he saw the ill effects of fantasy in people who allowed themselves to fall into the grip of fantasy. And many of the things that he has to say about fantasy are very negative. We've already quoted him as saying that some infernal types of souls are themselves the embodiment of fantasy and are surrounded by a whole atmosphere of fantasy. Now, we don't want to fall into that state, so we must learn to observe ourselves and see our fantasies. If we see our fantasies, we can learn to cope with them. If we see our fantasies, we can learn to analyze them. If we analyze our fantasies, we're going to discover something about ourselves. Because that which emerges into expression does so through a chain of internal factors and causes. There is some cause that stands behind our fantasy. The fantasy itself is just an end effect. So we have the universal law of cause and effect. Behind every manifestation of our being, there is an underlying cause. Now, one of the first men to try and cope with this was Carl Jung. Now, Carl Jung was one of the best psychologists that this world has ever seen. And in his day, he explored the psychology of religion, the psychology of the unconscious. He unfolded mythology, alchemy, and he put more together in his lifetime than all of his contemporaries together were able to assemble. He was a remarkable man. In his early days, he read the Arcana Celestia thoroughly and with great delight. And that undoubtedly laid foundations in his psyche. But Carl Jung went through an enormous developmental period in which he learned gradually to find himself. In this search for himself, he studied his fantasies. And he also realized that the study of fantasies in patients was something enormously important. He says, present-day medical psychology knows only too well that dire disturbances of the bodily functions, and there are devastating psychic consequences which can flow from mere fantasies. Fantasies are the natural expressions of the life of the unconscious. But since the unconscious is the psyche of all the body's autonomous functional complexes, its fantasies have an etiological significance that is not to be despised. Fantasies are, medically, real things with which psychotherapy must deal rigidly. Now, fantasy, instead of just being an idle daydream that means nothing, is being described here as pointing to underlying causes. And fantasies are etiological factors. They contribute to the elaboration of a person's neurosis or psychosis. And therefore, they are to be looked at seriously. Now, this is what we must do. We must learn to look at things seriously. Now, what did Jung get out of his fantasies? Here I'm going to quote something which is absolutely fascinating. He says, another fantasy figure arose out of my unconscious. I called him Philemon. He brought with him an Egypto-Hellenic atmosphere. I first saw him as a winged being sailing across the sky. He had the wings of a kingfisher and held a bunch of fork ears. Philemon represented a force which was not myself. In my fantasies, I held conversations with him, and he said things which I had not consciously thought. He said I treated thoughts as if I generated them myself. That's a pure Swedenborgian discovery too. It was he who taught me psychic objectivity, the reality of the psyche. Psychologically, Philemon represented superior insight. He was a mysterious figure to me. So here we have a fantasy which becomes objectified in such a way that Jung could see this figure for months and could mentally converse with it. And out of those conversations, he obtained insight into his psyche and into the whole process of psychotherapy. That's very fascinating because it ties up exactly with what Dr. Van Dusen describes in his book, The Presence of Other Worlds. Maybe some of you have read that book. Maybe some haven't, but read the chapter of Spirits in Madness. Dr. Van Dusen described high-order hallucinations which various patients have. And they are positive, guiding, inspiring, helping and healing influences which he discovered as an independent scientist. That's what happened in Jung's life. Now, this Philemon, this was quite interesting. He called the figure Philemon, and he said that it seemed to have an Egyptian and a Greek influence. He spelt it this way. Now it so happens, and I don't think Jung was aware of this, it so happens that in the 6th century AD there lived in Egypt an Abba Philemon. And his name was sometimes spelt like this. This was a real person. Now, he was a Greek priest who was searching for spiritual reality. But he lived in Egypt because he felt that the atmosphere was conducive to his spiritual growth. And he became an anchorite. That is, he went out into the desert in absolute isolation for the sake of trying to cleanse and purify his soul and to form a conscious connection with God. He was a real being, and some of his writings have come down to us through that extraordinary treasury of Eastern Orthodox religion, which is the Thylacalia. Now, the Thylacalia is a 4 or 5 volume collection of the writings of the fathers of the Eastern Church and of the early Christian Church. It's filled with all sorts of methods about how we can work upon ourselves, how we can change the level of our consciousness, how we can struggle against negativities. And here is one of the contributors to this. We're going to quote something from the Thylacalia quite shortly. Now, here we have a real man who was a spiritual adept. And through a twist of fate in some way, this same figure becomes transmogrified in Jung's fantasies, and he sees him as having these blue wings of a kingfisher, which indicates a spiritual atmosphere, and holding keys. Keys unlock doors to our understanding. And this is what was happening in Jung's life. After a while, he deliberately dissolved the figure of Philemon and began to rely upon his reasoning power, his intelligence. Now, he analyzed a lot of his own fantasies in just that way and found that they provided inroads to understanding new dimensions of the human psyche. So, here is somebody who learned to use fantasies correctly. Now, many of the fantasies that occur to people are not pleasant. We fantasize about our house being broken into, things being stolen, accidents happening to us, and then worry, in states of worry, wow, the fantasies build up so that they become absolute mountains, and we become frightened by them. This is when fantasies take on a negative characteristic. And some people become so subjected to the influence of certain fantasies that they become psychologically disturbed. They become ill. They become permanently depressed and worried. Now this is dangerous because Swedenborg has pointed out many times that when fantasies become entrenched in our minds on this planet, we take them through death with us into the spiritual world and we keep living them out there. So we've got to take a long view of our life and see that what we do on this planet may well repeat itself and continue to repeat itself in spiritual dimensions unless we correct them now. What we correct in this life will be automatically corrected for the future that lies ahead of us. Swedenborg is very strong on this, and that brings home a great lesson. If we observe our status in life now, if we see how we function, if we see the arising of automatic expressions, some of which are healthy, some of which are unhealthy, we should learn to correct the unhealthy states and discover new meanings, and thereby we'll save ourselves a spiritual burden later on. That long-term view of life is very important because it teaches us that here and now in this life we've got to clean up our act. Now there are some people who've studied Buddhism, they say, well look, it doesn't matter if you don't make it in this life, because when you reincarnate you'll have another bite of the cherry and all will be well. Ah, but there's complications, because some Buddhists say the next time you come around you may be a flea. You may reincarnate as a worm. So how are you going to work upon yourself in those conditions? You see, there are all sorts of traps here that become very, very difficult. All right, if a person does believe in reincarnation, believes there are many, many cycles, if they want to believe in it, and if it gives them comfort, that's fine. That's their personal belief. But they would be very stupid if they say to themselves, well, what happens in this life doesn't matter because I'm going to come back again and I can have a really good go at it then. We must treat this life as the only life in which we can transform ourselves. And that's what Buddha was trying to teach people. He said there are cycles of reincarnation, and I can remember some of my previous incarnations, but it is this life that is the life that leads to enlightenment. It's here and now that something must be done. Now if we get this sort of orientation, then we can learn to deal sensibly, soundly, rationally with our fantasies. Now let us try and see what some of the ancient Christian adepts did with regard to fantasies. They had a very interesting approach. Some of them actually wrestled with the fantasies, just like a man in a wrestling ring. Ancient Christian adepts, they wrestled with these fantasies because they felt that there were devilish forces getting at them, and there was a struggle that had to take place, and they undertook this struggle in solitude, usually in desert regions, and it was a very desperate struggle. It was an invisible warfare that was carried out, and some men went mad, others died under the stress and strain of it. But there were more rational kinds of spiritual adepts who found a different way of approaching it. And this man, Philemon, that we spoke of earlier, he formulated a prayer which became known as the Jesus Prayer. A lot of you people undoubtedly know it. Now this prayer was a very simple prayer, and it goes like this: Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy. That's the prayer. Ah, but here is the technique. The technique used by these early adepts was to consciously repeat that prayer between 8,000 and 10,000 times a day. That in itself is a big feat. Until the prayer became autonomous. When that prayer was singing of its own accord within the mind and you didn't have to think of it, it just sung and sung and sung away. Then through mental effort and visualization, that prayer, saying those words, would be moved down into the heart. Then it would be moved into the lungs, then into the liver, then into the kidneys, the genitals, the knees, the feet, brought up to the shoulders and back into the head. That is a tremendous effort. Now, not only did they repeat the prayer thousands of times like that, not only did they move the prayer around, but they focused very much upon the sacred content of the prayer. They concentrated on the meanings of the words of the prayer. They tried to visualize the meanings. And as a result of doing that, they found themselves suffused with a very fine energy, which gave them a feeling of harmony and bliss. And there were no fantasies. There were no fantasies. They had driven fantasies out of themselves. They were connecting themselves with an inner reality. Now, that was one of the outstanding things that came from the early writers of this magnificent set of writings, the Philokalia. These men practiced what they preached. They didn't just preach it, they practiced it. Now, we have to practice what we preach. You know, one of the craziest fantasies that exists in the world today is when people assume that they are Christians. You know, there are three kinds of Christians. There are those who call themselves Christians. There are those who try very hard to be Christians. And there's the rare few who are able to be Christians because they follow the precepts of Christ. They love them and they live them. And such people are rare. Now, the people who merely call themselves Christians are very often the ones who look down on others who stray off the path a little bit, condemn them. You will be in hell. The devil will get hold of you. They're living in this fantasy that they are Christians, which they're not, in fact. And they consider themselves to be very important people, upholders of the church and upholders of the community. That's a fantasy. That's self-deception. So even in what appear to be good ways, fantasies can arise that are quite dangerous. And you get this in young people today who are very enthusiastic about joining small Christian groups, and they sing their hymns and they have Bible readings, all of which is very good. But they only see the surface meaning of what they read and what they study. They don't see the inner contents and they don't live them. I heard of a case of a young boy of 15. He used to lock himself in his bedroom, praying. He'd pray for hours. His mother would knock on the door and call out, "John, it's time for dinner." And he'd come to the door and swear at her because she was interrupting his prayers. He was a really good Christian. Now, all right, so this technique which has come from ancient times, the repetition, the conscious repetition of a prayer till it becomes automatic, then getting the feeling out of it, getting the meanings of the words in great depth and passing that prayer from path to path. That's one of the ancient spiritual exercises that people should learn to follow. Try it for a week. See if you can do it for a week. You can repeat this prayer to yourself hundreds of times as you go shopping, as you're on the way to work, in the lunch hour, in the toilet, all sorts of places where we have a spare moment. If we try it, we find that something begins to click inside. Now remember, the aim of the prayer is to put down fantasies. Another teaching which comes from ancient times amongst the early Christian fathers is this: that when we enter into conscious discourse with God, that is, we hold an inner conversation with God as a being, a real, substantial, tangibly felt being, we become involved in this inner conversation and we feel it with our heart. That conversation that arises, whatever it's about, because it's a private thing between the divine and yourself, whilst that conversation is taking place, fantasy does not arise within our psyche. So, a proper inward conversational prayer with the divine is a very, very important way of loosening the bonds of fantasy which tend to grip us. So, since we all have fantasies, let's pick a fantasy now and again and try to look at its symbolic content in the same way as we try to unravel the symbolic meaning of a dream. You see, dreams are full of all sorts of rich, hidden contents. And sometimes we need an extensive knowledge of mythology in order to decipher the symbolic contents of a dream. Likewise with fantasies, we have to understand all sorts of connections, relationships, representations, symbols, correspondences. But we can, from our fantasies, reach either repressed or ignored or overlooked things in our own unconscious mind. So learning to make use of fantasies is a very, very important way of progressing through this universe. Now, sometimes fantasies reach a sort of a cosmic level. This is well understood in Hinduism. In Hinduism, you have the absolute divine creator unibeing. There we have the creator, and we have the universe. In Sanskrit, this is sometimes called Purusha and Prakriti. Now, some of the great sacred writings from the Indians say that there is a veil between the creator and the created universe. And this veil is referred to as Maya. Now, this Maya is very loosely translated, especially by Western authors, as illusion. Well, that's only one of its connotations. It means much more than that. But the idea that there is a veil between the creator and the visible universe is an important concept. Now, this does not mean that the creator has deliberately hidden himself behind a lot of fantasies so as to trick poor unfortunate human beings like us. Such is the nature of reality that the creative cause is always different from the visible end effects. There is always a tremendous difference between cause and effect. Now look, if we take an object like this and tap it on a table, a sound comes out. Two objects, quite material objects, we bring them together and a sound is generated. The effect is different from the cause. And that's how we must see with creation. The creator is utterly different from the visible creation, but is still connected with it. Now, people who live in the midst of this universe, all that they can see is this Maya. Maya is the illusion of reality. It's not the reality itself, it's what we think is the reality. I'm going to quote to you from an ancient piece of writing known as the Bhagavad Gita, which discusses this. Now, in this Bhagavad Gita, which means the song celestial or the blessed Lord's song, it is the divine which is speaking. This divine illusion or maya of mine, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. But those who have surrendered to me can easily cross beyond it. The evil-doing, the deluded, the vilest of men, they come not to me, they whose wisdom is destroyed by illusion, who have atheistically embraced the nature of demons. Now that's very heavy stuff. The divine says that there is an illusion, and human beings are trapped in that illusion. And the Gita goes on to say that all beings walk this world wholly deluded. Now, if we apply that to ourselves, it means that we look around and we see a remarkable universe filled with all sorts of extraordinary details. But because of this process or thing called Maya, we're only seeing the end effects of creation. We are not seeing the visible, or rather the invisible causes of creation. We don't see the reality. We're looking at a kind of cosmic fantasy. Now the Gita says that those who are able to make this hypakic outreach to the Lord God and receive into themselves the energies of the Lord God, they pass through this veil of illusion. Now we can't help being deluded by the appearance of things, because this is the way the universe works. We're going to demonstrate this quite easily. We depend utterly upon our senses for everything that we learn in this world. Supposing there's a blue flower sitting here, and we look at the blue flower. Are we seeing the blue flower, or are we seeing some strange kind of fantastic illusion? Alright, now let us say that we have a blue flower. We've got a blue pen here, so here is a blue flower. Now we look at it, but we can only see it because waves of light have to be reflected off that flower to pass into the eye, and in passing into the eye, the transparent tissues have to be traversed by these light waves. The light goes through the lens, and on the retina at the back we have an inverted image of the flower. Our eyes see the world upside down. Now that's weird. And then we have the optic nerves, which come back to the lateral geniculate body and then finally into the occipital region at the back of the brain. But what passes along these nerves? Only a kind of a Morse code. We have a whole series of electrochemical impulses passing along these nerves. There is no image, there is no picture of the flower passing along, there is no colour being passed along. It's only a series of dot and dash codings of nerve impulses. And finally, an image is somehow produced in the cerebral cells that's the right way up. Now, it is our consciousness, which is a different energy altogether, which perceives that image of the flower and interprets it. So we have a flower, light falls upon it, and it's only from the reflected light that an inverted image is formed. Electrochemical changes set up a train of nerve impulses. There is a sorting out of the impulses, more impulses, and bingo, we see a flower. We don't directly see the reality. It's impossible for us to directly see the reality of the flower. We don't see what the flower is in itself. We're getting an indirect image. Now it is that indirect image which is the process of Maya. It's the way the world is made. We are obliged to see the world indirectly and not directly. So everything we see, in a sense, is a kind of a fantasy. And we have to grope around in this fantasy trying to find what is true, what is stable, what is wholesome, what gives us a sense of integrity, that gives us a sense of meaning in life. Now that's true for all of our senses. Everything that we taste, touch, see, feel and hear reaches our internal consciousness through indirect pathways, and those indirect pathways greatly modify what is coming into us. So we're all in a very, very strange situation. Creation is absolutely queer in some respects, and I don't mean in an abnormal sense. It's strange. It's not what we think it is. Now, very often what we think is the nature of reality is quite unlike reality itself. Today we have a very, very systematic fantasy, and it's so systematically presented that it looks to be absolutely logical and watertight. But it is still a fantasy. Now let's see how it functions. Now we start off with a theory, and this is only a theory, that somewhere around about 12 or 15 billion years ago, some of these fantasizers must have been around to see it happen, if we believe them, there is a tiny little dob of energy. Now, they cannot explain how it got there. This is the weird part about it. You're starting with a colossal assumption. is a dot of energy, and it's very, very small. There's no space or time. But somehow this particle of energy just arose. And then it began to expand in all directions very rapidly. And all this took place with very, very short time intervals, such as 10 to the minus 23rd of a second. In that time, protons and electrons began to form. And then as the expansion continued after 3 or 4 seconds, molecules began to appear. And so the expansion continued, forming physical particles. Eventually, these physical particles coalesced to form galaxies. And inside the galaxies, all of these dust clouds and so on coalesced to form proto-suns, which eventually began to burn with thermonuclear energy. And then cooler bodies gathered around by gravitational force around these suns to form planets. And so world upon world of galaxies came out of this tiny little dot of energy. And it's still expanding. Scientists are worried. Is there enough matter in the universe to stop it expanding forever? We need gravity to start pulling it all back. Then it will all shrink back into that dob again. This is a fantasy. But the mathematics show that that's a possibility. Now, once planets have been established, here is a sun, and here is a planet. On the surface of planets, so the fantasy continues. With sunlight falling upon the planet, with moisture already there, generated by thermonuclear processes inside suns or stars, you have a brew of chemicals. Sunlight acts upon those, and by a marvelous act of coincidence, and this is a scientific assumption, by pure chance, all these chemicals coalesce to form a DNA molecule, which is a very, very complex thing indeed. Scientists are trying to unravel the human genome at the present time. And it's got billions of units in it. Ah, but this all assembles accidentally. That's the fantasy. DNA, quite accidentally, became a self-replicating molecule. And through all sorts of accidental chances, a cellular structure was built around it. And then the environment acting upon this changed the gene patterns. And so in a purely mechanical way, species after species of all sorts of creatures, from trilobites to dinosaurs to human beings, emerged mechanically. Now, all this wondrous complexity that we have in ourselves, it's still a jangling mass of atoms. Now, I'm speaking scientific theory in its most serious aspects. Nerve cells somehow mechanically assemble together. The biochemical processes inside those cells generate myriads and myriads of impulses. By some astonishing process, out of it oozes consciousness. But consciousness, according to the scientists, is only the product of enzymes acting upon fatty acids, upon carbohydrates and proteins. All of our thinking is an accidental outcome of a colossal accident in the first place. And the lesson that comes from it is this. Because we are all accidental arisings in a mechanical universe, life has no meaning. There is no meaning in our being here. We just happen to be here and we've got to make the most of it. And when death comes, that's the end. You're only a bunch of chemicals and you just fall apart. There's no future. Now that is the official fantasy taught in universities, taught in high schools throughout the Western world. It is a colossal fantasy, but because logic has been woven into it, it seems consistent. It seems to be coherent. And that's official doctrine. And when you have people who have been educated in that type of cosmological and biological thinking, and you try to introduce an alternative way of life, you'll have invectives thrown at you. You'll have criticisms of the worst kind. If you speak of spiritual things, oh, that's only a pathological state. My wife said to a friend one day something about the soul, and this friend, a recent graduate from the university, turned around and said, "The soul? That's just a mutation." A mutation of what, though? You see, this is the kind of terminology that's taking place in the world. This is the kind of thinking that is occurring. See, there are massive fantasies of many kinds in the world. That's only one of them. We have political fantasies. We have financial fantasies. We have experts who predict all sorts of changes which never occur. People are living in glorious fantasies and they write books about them. Now, to live in a state of fantasy is called the sleep state. Swedenborg had a great deal to say about people being asleep. Christ referred to some people as being asleep, worse still, dead. That is, as spiritually dead to the realities that organize their lives. We need to come to grips with reality if we can. But we can only do so if we work our way through this maic film of fantasy, which is simply all the end effects of the creative process striking our sense organs, and our sense organs in an indirect way form pictures and images of the things around us. They are not the realities, but they are the pointers to the realities. And that's the important thing. If we observe a plant, if we observe an animal in the world, we must see it as the end effect of something which generated it. So, if we have a form, then that form has a cause, and here is the observer. The observer sees the form, but doesn't know how to see the cause. That's what we must learn. We must learn to find our way to the cause. And this has been the quest always of genuine religion in depth. And it's out of genuine religion that these spiritual or esoteric practices emerged a long time ago. And these spiritual practices consist of observing ourselves, seeing the truth about ourselves, because unless we know who and what we are, how can we know the greater things? It's impossible. So, to sort out the fantasies that we have, to see the difference between fantasy in our own lives and directed thinking, is the first great step. Now, we're using another diagram for this. Now, in our minds, we have fantasies, and we also have directed thoughts. Directed thoughts make up our reason. Now, fantasies or imaginations are interesting because they are continuous, they go on of their own accord. We have an internal biopsychological energy which, like a car engine which has been left on out in the street, is turning over all the time. As long as there's fuel there, the engine's turning over. It's not driving the car along, the engine's just idling over. Now, that's what daydream and fantasy is about. There is an automatic circulation of energy through our brain, from the thalamus to the cortex, back to the thalamus, and it's this circulation which keeps daydreaming, fantasy, and loose imagination functioning all the time. It's only when we step in and we compel ourselves to think from A to B to C to D, and then we come to a conclusion, that we break the fantasy for a little while and we use deliberate, conscious, intentional thinking to link together things that we know, factual things that we've studied. We link them together in logical order and we reach a conclusion that we can demonstrate or prove or experiment with. Now, these are the two modes of thinking that everybody carries. But the whole trouble is this dominates more of our lives than we realize. We are in the grip of fantasy more often than we care to explain to ourselves. And therefore we have to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves. By studying our fantasies, like Jung, we can discover all sorts of fascinating things about our lives. We can discover the things are flowing out which are expressing or revealing the hidden things. Now remember that Greek word, the phantasine, which means to reveal, to disclose. Fantasies are symbolically disclosing hidden things within ourselves. Now some of those hidden things may be things of which we're ashamed. They may be wrong things. They may be angry things. They may be violent things. We don't like to admit it to ourselves, but Swedenborg compels us to face up to it, that we're a mass of rubbish. We're a mass of negativities. We're a bag of poo. Now we don't like to think of it, but that is looking at it honestly. We carry the rubbish, and we're living in that rubbish. And until we purify ourselves of a great deal of this rubbish, the better part of us cannot make that contact with higher life. And this was Swedenborg's perpetual plea. He says, we can, if we try, if we make a sincere aspiration, we can push ourselves out of ordinary thinking and we can begin to get a taste of spiritual and even celestial thinking. He's very emphatic about this. And so people sit down, maybe in a yogi position, and they sort of try to push themselves up a bit. Doesn't work that way. It's much more subtle than that. If you try that sort of thing, you're in danger of busting your puffer valve or something like that. And that's not worth the effort. It is a subtle process of separating ourselves from the kind of thinking we're immersed in constantly. So, we have a kind of a heavy cloud of thought, and that is fantasy. It's being generated all the time because it's part of this automatic flow of energy within us. It can't help but be that way. It's just like energy flowing from the sun. It doesn't stop, it's always there. Now, if we are caught in the midst of this, we may remain in the midst of it through all eternity if we're not very careful. But if we make some sort of a special effort, we may be able to find some subtle means of abstracting ourselves from fantasy by focusing upon things that relate to the good, to the true, to the beautiful, to the harmonious, and to the loving. Now that means we have to use directed thinking and really focus upon these, and not just on the words, not just on the thoughts, but we have to try and get into the inside of these words, and we have to say to ourselves, what is the good? What is meant by good? And don't go looking at dictionaries. They don't help very much. They just give the current connotations of words. We have to look into writings like Swedenborg, Jacob Boehme, and some of the teachings which have come down from ancient times. We get clues as to what is meant by the good, the true, and the beautiful. These words are signatures for huge cosmic functions and processes and potencies. Now, when we start to get the inward feeling of these things, as well as thinking about them, then we're able to draw ourselves gradually out of this cloud of fantasy. And then we begin to experience a little of what is real. Now, let's go back to that blue flower that we looked at, and through our sensory perception we got only an indirect picture of it. What is the reality that stands behind the blue flower? Well, we can only give a partial answer to this because all of us are very limited beings. Our minds, our psyches are tremendously restricted. Swedenborg gives us a wonderful clue. He says, the soul of every plant and the soul of every animal is an affection. Now, here's a thought. So, in our case, where it's the blue-flowered plant, we We can look at it from the outside, we can photograph it, we can dissect it, we can look at sections of the tissue under the microscope, we can see the phloem, the xylem, the parenchyma, we can extract the anthocyanins and learn a lot about the physical composition of the flower. But that's not the flower itself. That's only its visible, tangible pattern. Swedenborg says that behind the blue flower, there stands an affection. Now, an affection is a state of love. Now, if you read Swedenborg very carefully, love is the primary energy of reality. It's the creative force. Love has this extraordinary power of yielding itself, of sharing itself with all that exists. That total self-giving of the divine, that's love. It wishes that every existing thing experiences what the divine rejoices in: harmony, delight, consciousness, blessedness, bliss and peace. The divine tries to communicate this to all things. And that's loving giving, and that's the primary act of creation. Love is, of course, supported by wisdom. That knowledge of all laws and all truths, so that the energies of love are not just idly and loosely scattered, in a highly organized and harmonious way. Wisdom conjoins with love to generate pattern, form, law, order, and meaning. It's a remarkable thing. So where there is an affection, there must also be a formative wisdom. Now these are things which proceed from the divine. Those things collectively make up the soul of the plant, and that soul is its inner reality. Now we may say, but an affection, that's a pretty intangible sort of thing. Say that to yourself next time you get very angry about something. Your anger is a real energy. It's something that dynamizes you in a powerful way. This affection is not the affection of the plant. It's the divine affection, a state of patterned love, shaping itself and presenting itself in such a way that we see that pattern of affection as a blue flower. We see only the end effect and we misinterpret it, because we get into the depths of botany and we get caught up in chemistry and physiology, and then we start talking about the evolution of these things mechanically from an accidental beginning, and we lose ourselves in our fantasy. And all that is Maya for us. We get caught up in the world illusion and we don't see the reality that stands behind it. There's no botany book in the world that will tell you about the affections that shape the plants. There's no zoology book that will tell you about the affections and the wisdoms that shapes every animal. But that is the reality. Because we are capable of love and affection, because we are capable of discerning consciously the truths that are transmitted to us from ancient times, and we can imbibe these, and we can understand them, we can learn to live them. Because we have that capacity within ourselves, we have the capacity to see the affection and to see the operations of the inward wisdom. We see that all the patterns and the structures of that organism reflect something of these internal realities, and that's correspondence. And so every time we look at anything at all, we must say, what is the reality that stands behind this? That's our question. And that's the very thing that lifts us out of this cloud of fantasy towards the reality that we need to know. I'm not going to say that suddenly we're going to see the answer to everything. Some people try to find the answer to that, but it's impossible. There was an experiment in America some years ago. He felt that by taking certain very carefully measured doses of drugs, LSD, cocaine, and something else thrown in for good measure, and if he was left to himself, he'd been through an experience like this before, he would have a vision of the real. And this time he had a notebook, and he was going to record what his insights were. So he was, by a doctor, he was given this carefully measured dose of the drug. and he was seen through a one-way window writing something down furiously. Then he passed out. When he recovered, what he had written in the notebook was the secret of the universe, and the words were, "There is a smell of gas around here." Now that was a scientific experiment that was carried out, and this man who took the drug, he really thought that he was seeing the secrets of reality, but he said, "There's a smell of gas around here." You see, he is living in a fantasy. It's a phantasmagoria. He creates images which he feels is the real thing. But the outcome is so useless to him and to all the rest of us that it's not worthwhile. Once we get in a series of fantasies, it's so easy to follow that little pathway of reincarnation inside, that we reincarnate from day to day, from minute to minute, from week to week, back inside the same vicious circuit. To escape from that is transformation. That's rebirth. And rebirth is not just a religious term that means you become good and Jesus has patted you on the head and you're sprouting wings where your shoulder blades were and you're growing a third set of teeth and so on. It doesn't mean that. That's another set of fantasies that people generate. We pass from a state of being inwardly asleep to a state of being awake. And we then become sensitive to the actual reality which is everywhere around us. But it's so vast that we can't take it all in. We see fragments of it. We touch segments of it. We rejoice in new states that enter us. And that's just the beginning. Because it's infinite, it takes all eternity and more to explore even a fraction of it. Now that's what we have to look forward to. So, instead of living in a state of constant fantasy, we must live intelligently with rationality, with reason, and try to make something of our lives. It'd be nice to be able to wipe away fantasies like this, wouldn't it? But we can't. As long as we live, even in the spiritual realm, we're going to have fantasies. Now we must use our reasoning power to cope with fantasy. Fantasy is at a lesser psychological level than reason. So we can develop a little scale. Here we have the power of reason or rationality, and down here we shall have fantasy. We'll spell it a different way for once, just to be different. Now, fantasy is automatic. It doesn't require any effort. As you know, it's so easy to slip into a daydream, and daydreams can be very, very pleasant. Sometimes they can be disturbing. But that's automatic. But it requires effort to carry out that directed thinking. And if we carry out that directed thinking in the search for meaning, then we begin to create a spiritual pathway for ourselves. Especially if we have assimilated into ourselves a very great collection of high truths. We can't just think our way into a greater state of reality. We don't know how the universe was brought into being. And if we start inventing, we're going to be as bad as the materialists who just conjure something up. Because it looks good, it looks reasonable. High truths are always being transmitted from the divine, from the celestial worlds to us. Because knowledge, wisdom, disclosure, revelation, inspiration is spiritual food for us. It's a fine substance, and our inner being, which is a fine substance, has to be fed all the time. When we are searching for reasons and meanings, for goals that we can actually pursue with fervor, with enthusiasm, and with sincerity, we feed upon these high truths and we begin to apply them. We apply them because we develop within ourselves love of them. If we love truths because we see that they are truths, we see that there is a greater reality that we can't immediately come to direct grips with, but we can reach our way into it and sense it and attune ourselves to it. If we can be patient and work in such a way as to withdraw ourselves from this world of daydream and fantasy, then we can reach this more reasonable way, which takes us towards our own reality. And that is self-discovery. We don't learn it overnight. We don't learn it by a trick or a technique. It is through long, sincere effort that we gain enlightenment. Now, if we take the example of Buddha, the story goes that Buddha was a disenchanted prince, brought up in states of wealth and protected from all the evils of the world. He managed to get out into the world and he saw all this terrible anguish and suffering, and he wanted to understand why suffering existed. And we're told that he wandered around, did this, that and the other, and then he sat under a bo tree, which is a big fig tree, and after some hours, bingo, he attains nirvana, enlightenment. He meditated his way into complete consciousness of what things are. But what he found was so wonderful he couldn't describe it, so he called it nirvana, a snuffing out. Now that's the popular story, and like all popular stories, it is incomplete and it's deceptive, because when we very carefully study the life of Buddha, Buddha did start out as a disenchanted person. He came across suffering and wanted to understand why, but he went and lived with spiritual adepts for years, and he studied under them and carried out their practices, but he didn't get what he was looking for. But there was training, very severe and honest training. Then he underwent, starved himself for long periods of time and just lived on watery extracts of plants. That still didn't give him what he sought. Then he met up with a whole lot of yogins, and he was with them for about 10 years, sincerely following their methods. He still didn't attain what he was after, and eventually, in great desperation, he finally focused upon himself. And when he sat under that bo tree, he said, "I will not move from this spot until I see what the reality is." Without all that prior training and suffering and effort, he wouldn't have gained that enlightenment. But idiots today think if they go to a meditation class, "Oh, you don't need that. Just sit there and you're in an elevator. God will lift you straight up to the 10,000th heaven." People really believe that. A lady came to one of my groups recently and she said, "I've come for 2 nights now and you haven't said a word about meditation. Why are you talking about all these complexities of mind and celestial and spiritual levels?" She said, "In meditation I can be right up there." She hasn't come back. Now that's deception. That is self-deception. And she was a very simplistic kind of person who probably didn't understand what makes a toe-itch. Without a lot of sincere investment of our energies in trying to find the truth, we shall never reach the truth. Christ's challenge was, "Knock and it shall be opened unto you. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and ye shall find it." And that means making an effort. Now, because life is such an incredibly wonderful experience, and because we cannot biologically just explain all of our states and our hopes and aspirations, there is something deeper in life that can be sought for. And it requires us to get behind our illusions, to get behind our imaginations and our fantasies, to try and find what is stable, what is wholesome, what is real, what is worth living for, what is worth struggling for. We don't just get it out of books. We won't even get it out of Swedenborg. What we have to do is read Swedenborg and then translate his words into actions, feelings, and aspirations. We must make his words live. Then something will happen. Just theory alone will not change a thing. We live in a world that is governed by space-time dimensions. If we make only space-time efforts, we're not going to escape from space and time. So let us say that here is the dimensionality of the world, space and time locked together. If we assume that space, time, matter and energy are the only things that make our reality, and we try to use all those methods to somehow escape into timeless, spaceless worlds, that's impossible. That's like trying to lift yourself up with your own shoestrings. Can't be done. If we wish to make that transition, we have to first of all get something of the timeless and of the eternal, something with inexhaustible energy, with inexhaustible meaning into ourselves. With that sort of illumination, we can see then what we have to do. We can see how we need to act upon ourselves in order to release ourselves from our internal bondage and grow. Everybody is in a state of bondage. We don't recognize this. Now, I'm not talking about the strange sort of bondage you get in William Street and other places like that. We're talking about being enclosed in a strange psychological state. Now, that's an Egyptian symbol, and it's pronounced per, and it means a house. Now remember, the Israelites were trapped in Egypt in the house of bondage. That's how it was described. But what is the house of bondage? It is identification with sensuality and with fantasy, because the two go together. Our fantasies are built up out of our sense experiences. People fantasize about the most incredible things, but they're always things that are tangible in their own way. A young fellow full of passion has no girlfriend. He's thinking of the most voluptuous, gorgeous, curvaceous thing that could ever exist in the universe. That's his fantasy. Some yogis live by means of fantasies like that. There are some yogins in India, they say, no, we practice chastity. We don't indulge in sex with a woman. But they will produce fantasies in their chest where they see themselves being united with the Dakini, a kind of a female fairy. And they have the most ecstatic orgasms in their chest. That's a fantasy, and they live it out. But they're being good and pure because they're not having actual physical sex with a woman. Christ said there's no difference between that sort of inward act and the actual outward act itself. So they're deceiving themselves. Fantasy is a trap. And so we need the power of reasoning and rationality, and we need sound, high truths to guide us. We can't just steer our own way through life, because that's only guesswork. We don't know the directions in which to head. But if we can see that we're trapped inside a house of bondage, which is attachment to our sense organs, and that's the maya or the illusion. We see the visible end effects of creation, and we think that's the only reality there, that there is. That's maya. It's not a trick on the part of God. Everything of a spiritual nature has to condense and take on a fixed end pattern in order to function. Visible things are necessary for the completion of creation. But if we say that that's all there is to creation, then we're sunk. We're in the trap. We're in that house of bondage. Now, we have the sort of bunch of Israelites within ourselves who can be led out of the house of bondage, just as Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt. That's a parable. It's a parable that is as true today for ourselves as it was 2,000-3,000 years ago. It's quite true for us, with rationality, with high truths to guide us, with the realization that we are entrapped and there is a way of escape. We can get out of it. Now, those early adepts who wrote that Philokalia, they found ways and means of doing it. We've quoted two of those ways and means. Enter into frequent discourse with God. Internal conversations with God. It may sound to be seem like a silly thing to do, but it isn't. It's a very rational, logical thing to carry out. and say to yourself, look, I'm here. In this world, I'm alive. I've got sensation. I've got the joy of participating in myriads and myriads of different types of experiences. I can learn things. I can rejoice in everything that's taking place. And from out of that, when we think about it, we develop a gratitude for having been placed in this universe to see everything that is taking place. It's out of that gratitude that we develop, slowly and surely, love for God. That love for God is reciprocal to the extent that we're able to open ourselves to the divine, so the love of the divine flows into us accordingly. We're the ones who need to open that door. So, the responsibility is with us. Get out of this house of illusion. That's a house with many mirrors in. You can be trapped there. And it's our senses that trap us. Not that they're put there deliberately to trap us and deceive us. We're given senses so that we can interact with other aspects of creation. Swedenborg speaks about a race of people before history began. And he described them as having celestial qualities. And he indicated that they were not trapped by fantasy. Their inner senses were opened, and they're able to converse with celestial beings, and everything that they looked at became vibrant, alive, and they saw meanings and values and qualities in everything that they looked at. And that was the natural science of correspondences. Later generations of people fell away from that state. The psychological center of gravity moved from this inner, innocent perception to this sense-based perception. And when we get involved in the senses, we start to be deceived by the appearances of things. We no longer see the underlying reality that makes visible things become available to our senses. So we have this remarkable thing that either we look at the reality or we look at the sensory end effects. We have the choice. And that choice depends upon what we love most of all. If the phenomena of the world are so attractive to us that we want to keep on burying ourselves in phenomena, getting hold of things, owning things, exercising power over things, taking things to pieces to see how they work, then we can get completely lost in that and we lose sight of the reality that we're searching for. This is the danger that modern quantum physicists are aware of. They say, right, we're uncovering the inner structure of the atom. We get down to electrons and protons, we get amongst the muons and the tau particles and the mesons and so on. But they are not the reality. What is the reality that stands behind all of these fundamental particles? They know there is something there, but they can't give the answer. It's only a few gifted people like Professor Paul Davies, who is now living in Australia. He is game to talk about the things that lie beyond physics. He's a physicist himself, but he writes these books, The Mind of God, and his latest one, On Time, deals with the reality that is known to be there, but no scientist can put it in a form that's acceptable to other scientists, because everybody in the scientific field is speaking about external sensory things. Reality is non-sensory because it's the root cause of everything that produces sensation in us, and it's objects that produce sensation. So the average person is in a catch-22 situation. As long as we rely totally upon our sensory perception, we've got a limited view of the world, and it's a very important view of the world, but it's not all the world. Coming to that discovery within ourselves makes us ask, well, what then is the reality that stands behind this? Now, people give all sorts of terms and names to these things. And two very popular terms are as follows. And here we get a little bit theological. People have very deep wishes for something wonderful to follow this life. And so people form the idea of paradise. And other people form an idea of heaven. So these are two things that people blindly look forward to. They blindly look forward to it. And if it's not that, then it's a sort of an eternal rest. You look what's written on gravestones in many cemeteries. Asleep in the bosom of God and so on. You know, an inertia. Who the heck wants to die to become an inert? Nothing. That's a terrible view. It's an appalling view. And then everybody is waiting of this disposition for that last day in which the trumpet blows. And as we've said before, that's going to be Louis Armstrong, and he's going to play when the saints come marching home. And everybody's going to jump out of their graves and they're going to dance the most delightful dances ever known. And see, this is a fantasy, but so many people believe it in that form. And when we look at it, it's ridiculous. Alright, well, that's the common belief of people. Fantasies help to formulate widespread beliefs. We've got to break through the fantasy and look at the reality. We're only flies in the cosmos. We are nothing of ourselves. But we become something when we are connected with everything that comes from the reality that has brought us into being. Things are flowing into us, but as long as we think that we are pretty important beings, we're pretty hot stuff in what we do and so on, we pretend that nothing else is involved in life, that there is nothing greater than ourselves. That's self-love. Self-love occurs when a person looks in the mirror and forms a lifelong attachment. And it's very easy to get into that state. It's so easy because we feel that I must be important because, well, God wouldn't have created me to be here if I weren't important. And that can boost the ego if we're not very careful. It is true that we are here because we are important. We are important to greater ongoing cosmic purposes. We belong to a much greater order than we recognize. We put our purposes first and foremost. We forget that we are needed in this cosmos. That's why Christ said, in patience possess ye your souls. You've got to possess your souls because the soul is needed elsewhere in the cosmos for huge functions and processes which cannot possibly be put into words. That's the reality that confronts us. That's the reality that takes us out of ourselves. So we have this situation. The scientist knows that behind the visible there is a reality, but he doesn't know how to formulate it. We know and believe that in our lives there is something very significant and very important, but again, we cannot readily formulate it because we want to make it into a philosophy, or we want to make it even into a science. We want a nice, clear picture of what we're moving into. We place the demands on God. We say, I'm not going to get into heaven until you tell me what heaven is all about. We play hard to get. And in that way, we keep enclosing ourselves in this house of bondage. We're the ones who are at fault because we're looking in the wrong direction for our reality. Now let us go back to what we discussed a little earlier. Behind the plant there was an affection, and the affection is part of a very great conatus or drive that comes from the divine. It's forever seeking to make itself known. There is an interesting Sufi statement that says, I was a hidden treasure and I desired to be known, so I created the universe. And that's a very lovely picture, that the divine in its reality, it seeks to share its reality, but until there are things there to share the reality, well, nothing can happen. It's only when creation is produced you have recipients for what pours out of the divine. Now, behind the plant there stands an affection, there stands a conatus. Now, each one of us can say this to ourselves. Behind me there stands an affection, or a cluster of affections, which have brought me into being. And all that is part of this great drive, this yearning, this outreach of the divine to share the totality of his being, consciousness, bliss with us. That's the reality, but we can't put it into a shape or a form. We are the shape and the form within ourselves of everything that is being said here. To grasp reality, it needs a set of other senses than we have at the present time. We've got our five senses, but we need our inner senses to see the reality. So the awakening of those inner senses . This depends upon the willingness with which we accept the fact that we have an invisible part to us, which is our mind-spirit dimension, as well as the visible part, which is the bodily part. We use this invisible part of ourselves all the time. We don't see our thoughts. We don't see the surges of emotion. We don't see our memories as things moving around. Even the electroencephalograph, which measures brain waves, doesn't show up thoughts. It doesn't show up patterns of feeling. It shows up a lot of neurological rhythms. There is so much in our lives we cannot come to grips with. Just as no scientist has ever seen an individual electron, neither do we see the substance of our thoughts, neither do we see the substance of our feelings, but we experience them. And we experience them as end effects. Learning to move from the end effects into this rich life of feeling and loving and sensing and participating, that helps to open up spiritual senses within us. To feel the flow of life coming through us as part of the great divine conatus or urge, that's to get a new consciousness of where we've come from and what we actually belong to. We don't even belong to ourselves. We belong to that which has brought us forth. And all of that is the reality. So it means that we have to think in a new way to appreciate the internal dynamics that make us what we are. And it means this, and this is quite remarkable. In our state of being me, we have a very limited biological form. Only limited dimensions. The whole surface of our body is only about 1.8 square meters, size of a small mat. And the whole of our life is contained in that. That's our actuality. All of this is our potentiality. It's what can eventually flow through us. Our potentiality infinitely outweighs our actuality. If we regard the actuality as real, then we're mistaken. All that we can experience is the appearance of the way things seem to be to our senses. We must make our thinking and our consciousness reach up into and participate in these eternal, ongoing, substantial realities. We find that they're not just words, they're not just empty states. There are endless treasure houses of qualities, of feelings, of visions and illuminations and energies and fine substances and rich experiences without end. That's the reality. It's endless. Now when we learn to trust that, then we can prepare ourselves for what is already present in us, resurrection. Resurrection has to take place now. We have to have a new life open up in us here now whilst we're alive. Not passively wait till death lifts us out of the body. To be consciously resurrected is to enter into the enjoyment of something of reality whilst we're still in the sensory life. That bigger life of feelings and perceptions will embrace the physical life with its external feelings. This is a bigger consciousness. It sees how all of this external world fits together. new meaning, new insight comes into play. Now that's having the cosmic view of things. Swedenborg is perpetually trying to get people to see these bigger realities within which we fit, as in a great framework. That's wholesome, healthy thinking. And it's well within our capacities to discipline ourselves to begin to think and feel and act in this way. Like the Israelites being led out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, so the real part of us is led out of its involvement with fantasies, with sensory identifications, with egotistic attachment, into a world that is so full, that is so free, so completely flowing and flexible and generating new states all the time, that the only way I can describe it is heavenly. Look, I'd like to thank you ever so much for coming tonight to stream. Thank you.